From this kingdom of Malabar and from another near it called Gujarat, wrote the great Venetian explorer Marco Polo, there go forth every year more than 100 corsair vessels on cruise. These pirates take with them their wives and children and stay out the whole summer. Fleets of up to 30 pirate vessels, Marco Polo recorded, would form giant nets across the sea to catch their plump merchant prey. For when one corsair sights a vessel, a signal is made by fire or smoke, and then the whole of them make for this and seize the merchants and plunder them. Last week, when the INS Kolkata and Indian Navy Special Forces soldiers rescued the hijacked bulk carrier MV Ruen from Somali pirates, the significance of the message was hard to miss. Facing threats to its energy and trade routes through the Indian Ocean, India was saying it's determined to discharge its role as the region's primary maritime security provider. The growing naval security mission marks a dramatic break from history. In the past, the failure of Indian rulers to develop true ocean-going navies allowed colonial powers to exert control across the region. There's also a challenge to India's ambitions, though, which isn't talked about quite so much. Eventually, the battle to secure the oceans, history shows, also has to be fought on dry land. From the dawn of history, great pirate fleets operated across India's western seas. Early in the first millennium, Roman chronicler Gaius Plinius Secundus, also known as Pliny the Elder, recorded that vessels headed to the Malabar coast carried companies of archers because the coast was, I quote, greatly infested with pirates. The Portuguese sailor Duarte Barbosa, 1600 years after Pliny, described pirate attacks thus, I quote, a multitude of them gather all armed with bows and arrows in plenty, and thus they surround any vessel they find becalmed with flights of arrows until they take and rob. The account of the scholar Muhammad ibn Battuta, whose ship was pillaged by a fleet of 12 pirate boats, described these attackers as infidels, which gives us a little bit of a clue to their identity. The 15th century account of the great Russian explorer, Afsani Nikitin, similarly said that the pirates were neither Christians nor Muslims, they pray to stone idols and know not Christ. Like many other marginal communities in medieval India, historian Sebastian Prange explains in a magnificent essay, Malabar's Mukkuvar fishing caste turned to looting merchant traffic during times of hardship, like the fishing off-season. Led by their headmen, the fishermen pirates used maneuverability and speed to overcome larger ocean-going merchant vessels, which were often defended by mercenaries. The pirates, Prange notes, operated as part of an organized protection racket. You see, local rulers used the threat of violence to extract taxes from the merchants. If they didn't pay up, well, they were always the pirates. The ports of the pirates, French navigator François Piard of Laval wrote, were, and I quote, well fortified on the seaside only, for with the Nayar kings who have given them these refuge, they have a good understanding, being subject to their judicature and paying them tribute. This understanding is highly profitable to these petty Nayar kings. Even the arrival of the great Portuguese caravel fleets with their high-speed and deck-mounted artillery did not extinguish the pirate threat. Led by the first pirate king, Kunali Marakkar I, historian A.P. Ibrahim Kunju writes, Malabar Muslims turned pirates to protect their long-standing monopoly of the spice trade, which the Portuguese were intruding on. The Portuguese retaliated by repeatedly sacking the pirate citadel at Ponani. The Kunali Marakkar pirates played a key role in the defeat of the Portuguese at the famous maritime battle of Chaul, fought in alliance between the Zamorin of Kozhikode, Ali Adil Shah of Bijapur, and Murtaza Nizam Shah of Ahmednagar. The battle would lead to the fall of the Portuguese fort of Chalia and led for a time for questions to be raised about how successful and powerful Portuguese colonialism would actually prove. Later, however, Kunali Marakkar IV developed territorial ambitions of his own and began describing himself as the Lord of the Malabar Muslims. Obviously, the Zamorin of Kozhikode was not pleased. The 17th century eyewitness account of Portuguese historian and poet Manuel de Faria e Sousa recorded that the Cunhali Maraca king insulted the Zamorin and, I quote, caused the tail of one of his elephants to be cut off, as also the private parts of a Nair, which were also fastened to his mouth. Pretty violent stuff. The Zamorin, alarmed, allied with the Portuguese and crushed the Cunhali Maraca. The king and his sons were executed in the year 1600 CE. Little acknowledged, Indian rulers did establish significant merchant fleets in the late medieval period. The merchant navy of Surat, Prangle writes, contained at least 112 ships by 1701, twice the number it had just 10 years earlier. For the most part, though, the Mughals and their vassals were reliant on European protection on the high seas. Instead, they thought that using land routes to exert influence, since they could choke European supplies, was enough to give them the leverage they needed. But from the mid-18th century, as Mughal power began to wane, that option slowly closed. And in the centuries to come, India would pay a high price for its lack of credible naval power. Late in 1994, a group of armed men calling themselves the Somali Coast Guard boarded the merchant vessel Bonsella, 3 miles off Kalula, the northernmost point of Somalia. 200 years after the Cunhali Maraca pirates, the threat had begun to resurface on the other end of the Indian Ocean. The hijackers told the crew of the Bonsella that they needed a vessel faster than their dhow to chase down illegal fishing boats. 6 days of unsuccessful raiding later, the hijackers emptied the Bonsella's cargo, relieved the crew of whatever money they had, and left the ship. Future attempts, though, would grow in sophistication, organization, and competence. Last year, the Indian Ocean was lifted from a list of regions at high risk of piracy. A more than decade-long multinational naval commitment seemed to have paid off, and the pirates seemed to have been crushed. The threat, though, resurfaced almost within days after Western navies pulled out their ships to deal with Houthi attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. Though separated by centuries, the world of the Somali pirates and the Malabar Mukkuvar are almost identical. Ever since the collapse of the Marxist-Leninist regime of Mohammed Siad Barre, Somalia has suffered endless civil war and the complete absence of central authority, scholar Ken Menkhouse has recorded. The country is among the poorest in the world. From the mid-1990s, low-grade pirate attacks began off the Somali coast, organized by fishing communities that had lost their livelihood to foreign commercial shipping. Though Somalia passed laws to prevent illegal fishing by the Chinese fleet, researcher Mariama Sao notes, it had no capacity anymore to enforce these laws. The destruction caused by the December 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami to fishing villages along the Somali coast ensured there was an abundant workforce available to raise pirate armies, scholars Peter Lair and Hendrik Lehman suggest. Local communities who had earlier made their living from fishing now turn to the most of another resource just off their coast. The 20,000 merchant vessels or so which transit the Gulf of Aden every year. From 2005, historian Edward Lucas has recorded, there was a sharp uptick in Somali pirate attacks. Factional competition fueled this growth. You see, rival warlords had figured out that the ransoms from hijacked vessels could be used to pay for ransoms. That meant that the fishing communities were able to escalate up the ladder from being small-time pirates to becoming relatively sophisticated organizations or cartels. Even as international navies moved in to secure the Indian Ocean, violence continued to surge. The Ukrainian-flagged Faina, loaded with tanks and anti-aircraft guns, is believed to have brought in a $3.2 million ransom for the ship, of course, but also its cargo and the lives of the crew. The supertanker Sirius Star netted the pirate cartel some $3 million. The Thailand-owned Thor Nexus and its 27 crew, hijacked 560 kilometers off the coast of Oman, were ransomed for $5 million. In 2010 alone, pirates attacked 219 ships, successfully hijacking 49 of them and kidnapping 1,016 sailors. Garowe, in the region of Puntland, came to host a kind of informal stock exchange where cartels could invest money to fund their future pirate attacks and operations. Banks based in Hong Kong and Singapore helped route ransom payments from owners to the pirates, while British-owned firms based in Kenya conducted negotiations and actually airdropped cash to the cartels waiting below in Garowe. Finally, the pirates were defeated on land, not the sea. An African Union-led peacekeeping mission that had begun in 2007 brought stability to some parts of the country. The coastal Puntland region also began clamping down on the pirate cartels in an effort to secure international funding and some sort of recognition of its autonomous status. Even though multinational operations against the pirates went on for years, efforts to legally prosecute the pirates met with very little success. All nations, in theory, have jurisdiction to prosecute crimes on the high seas. European countries, though, have fought shy of staging trials on their soil, fearing the alleged perpetrators from war-torn Somalia would make claims for asylum and, who knows, maybe succeed. For its part, India has prosecuted just one group, which spent some years in jail before being flown back to Somalia. Kenya has made the most sustained effort, but it lacks the means to act against pirate bases inside Somalia itself. In effect, there's been a policy of catch and release. And catch and release legal expert James Thuogathi bluntly notes is no deterrent at all. Things seem set to get worse. Puntland, which is home to key ports like Garowe, has become mired in intra-tribal warfare, which gives space to the pirate cartels. African Union peacekeepers are now in the process of drawing down troops, which will leave cartels and the swathe of insurgent groups, including Al-Qaeda, that operate in the region, free to gain momentum. Even though enhanced naval patrolling can suppress piracy, the resurgence shows it's an expensive band-aid, not a solution. The famous historian of piracy, Philip Goss, suggested its practitioners evolve from small-time criminals to larger professional cartels, which can then grow into proto-states. In Somalia, which is now locked in a struggle between rival warlords as well as jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda, the idea that piracy could allow one of these organizations to grow into some kind of proto-state is a truly terrifying prospect. Like it's done on the high seas, India needs to show leadership on dry land too and push the world into committing to the military and economic reconstruction of Somalia. Without that, the battle against piracy cannot and will not be won. I'm Praveen Swamy, and I'm a contributing editor at The Print. Thank you for watching Security Code.